Project. Today, we are throwing you back to episode 204 with Joel Jameson. Joel Jameson is one of the most famous strength and conditioning coaches on the planet, most famous actually for his conditioning. He's got a book called 8 Weeks Out. We have followed his journey for a very long time. It was an honor to finally get him on the podcast. Since the recording of this episode, we've stayed in touch. He actually was purchasing some of our training journals, which was super cool. He sent us a message about those. He's just one of those guys that you get the feeling that he's just a lifelong learner. He just loves education. He loves learning. He loves refining his processes and making things better. And I think he's got a really good work ethic. There's something definitely in common with a lot of these guys. You see him. They're not posting heaps on social media because often they don't have the time. Like there's a lot that goes into social media, and they're just really invested in their athlete success, constantly developing, you know, better energy system training techniques and all the stuff that's going to like really help them fulfill what they enjoy most, which is coaching.
Yeah, he's on the cutting edge when it comes to conditioning. Like he's in the research. You see so many other big name coaches just using his stuff.
Yeah.
I couldn't recommend his, you know, just online material. Some of the stuff he wrote over a decade ago is still awesome. His book, he was talking about HRV, you know, years before. I think while the guy that made Whoop was still in college.
Yeah.
You know, he really is ahead of the curve.
Well before that.
Yeah. So we were really excited to have him on.
Yeah. And the last thing I'll add to it since then is my brother, for those of you who know and don't know, is a professional MMA fighter. He's in Auckland right now training, and they're basically the number one gym in the Southern Hemisphere, and their conditioning sessions are the 8 weeks out protocols.
Wow.
So they use them religiously. So my brother will be like, oh yeah, we've got like alactic intervals today, or we got like, you know, lactic power repeats or something like that. So they do that stuff continuously, and these are the best guys in the world. And he says, you know, it is the best conditioning training that you can do.
It just gets you in wicked shape.
Yeah, it's just incredible stuff. So we were pumped about this episode, and we're also pumped up by True Coach. It's an amazing piece of software that anyone can use if you're training one client, if you're training 100 clients. It just makes your job so much easier, and it gets better. It's one of those things that the more you use it, the better it gets, because you start storing more programs in there. Say you write 10 programs from scratch, and they're fully individualized. You can take sections of those programs and turn them into templates. So say you write a really amazing 4-week conditioning block, and you're like, wow, that was awesome. That works so well. I really don't want to dig through hundreds of thousands of spreadsheets and find it again and copy and paste it across, but now it's in a different format to how I'm writing programs now and it doesn't work. No, you can save that 4-week block as a conditioning template, whatever it might be, power work, conditioning work, interval work, and then you can use it again for other people. And it's like, it's in a matter of a couple clicks.
But you can even go one step further. It's like you can give that template to 7 people. And then maybe in like 2 weeks time, you can be like, oh, you know what? I actually want to change one thing in that program.
Yeah.
You can change like one thing, like 9 reps instead of 10, and then just live update it across everybody you've given that program to.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. So you guys can get our True Coach offer, which is a free trial, and then obviously a discount once you decide to join. And that link to that is in the description of this episode. All right, guys, here comes our amazing episode with Joel Jameson. This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Raph Friedman, and you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
The Mind Muscle Project.
All right, Mind Muscle Project, welcome back to another episode. And today we have another person who we've talked about on the podcast for a long time, who we've managed to capture, and we're very, very fortunate to have him here. This man is Joel Jameson. His book, Ultimate MMA Conditioning, is looking like it looks pretty old in our shelf. You know when books look really old that you can almost blow the dust off them? That is that book. We ordered a copy, I want to say 7 or 8 years ago. Raph took the liberty of highlighting certain sections in pen, not highlighter. Thanks for that, Raph. So he defaced it a little bit, but regardless,
I would say every page.
Yeah. Regardless, it's probably the best book, or the number one book I go to recommend people to use when they're learning about the basics of conditioning and training athletes and programming. And we've used it at the gym for a long time. We've used it in our own training, and it's been basically the foundation of the gym's program for a long time. And that author is Joel, and he's here today. We want to talk about lots of different things. He's also, some of you might know, Demetrius Johnson. He does have the longest win streak as a UFC champ in the history of the UFC, which obviously recently just got broken, which is unfortunate. We won't talk about it too much. It was controversial.
Nothing
just put
to
it
do
that,
with his conditioning.
Just put it that way. But his conditioning was fantastic. That was the main thing. He was popping up after each round and running back to his corner. But Joel is part of his strength and conditioning team, or head of his strength and conditioning, and part of his coaching squad. But Joel, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's good to good chat with you guys.
Awesome. No, thank you so much for being here. I wanted to open up today with an article that I read of yours, and Raf mentioned that you were talking about it on the Powercast a few years ago. So I thought when I was reading the article, it was relatively new, but regardless, it was probably one of the best articles I've read from you, and it's something I always think about. And I think you'll do a better job of explaining the concept than I do. But I do have follow-up questions still. But essentially, in this article, you were talking about how humans have basically a set amount of calories that they can burn each day. So the idea that running 10Ks to burn 10,000 calories then moves on to 20,000 calories burnt to run 20Ks is actually a bit of a myth. And instead, what happens is that you have only 10,000 calories to burn. And so if you're going to run 20Ks, your body has a very intuitive system to downregulate other processes in the body so that you only stay under 10,000 or only hit 10,000, regardless if you're running 5Ks, 10Ks, or 20Ks. So that is an extremely interesting concept. And John, I'm interested, where did that come from? How did you kind of start along that thought train? And where are you now with that concept?
Yeah, you know, it's definitely interesting because it's so counterintuitive. We obviously think like the more we do, the more calories we burn. And it's just a natural thought. Like you said, if I go twice as far, I must have burned twice as many calories. But, you know, I started digging into the research, and they had done some research where they looked at different groups of people, and they looked at activity levels by just tracking steps and activity. And then they looked at calorie burn. And the way that we typically measure calorie burn is just looking at activity, right? We use Fitbits or we use some sort of trackers, and the tracker says, well, you moved this many steps, so you burn this many calories. But they actually used a much more sophisticated way to measure calorie burn, called indirect calorimetry. Used a whole different scientific technique to measure actual caloric burn. And what they found was that this relationship wasn't linear like we thought. So just because you walked 20,000 steps doesn't mean you burned twice as many calories as if you only walked 10,000 steps. And they found basically that your body has a max limit of how many calories it can produce or burn in a day, and that it's much more limited than we thought. And it's like probably nowhere near 10,000 calories for most people, to be honest with you. And they basically just found that once you start expending more energy beyond that, it doesn't just appear from nowhere. It's taken from other areas, other resources that, you know, energy could be driven to. So it was, like I said, it wasn't like my idea. This whole thing came from what's called the constrained energy theory of, you know, of metabolism. Basically, it's just been proven over different periods of time. Now, they looked at mice, for example. They looked at mice that were sedentary, mice that were moderately active, and mice that were extremely active. And the mice that were extremely active didn't actually burn more calories in a day than the mice that were moderately active. And when they looked at all different groups of people, they found that, you know, this hunter-gatherer tribe down in Africa didn't actually burn more calories in a day than your average person in the U.S. who was equally, you know, had some measure of activity, because going above a moderate activity level doesn't actually increase total caloric burn. So it's just a very fascinating idea that simply our metabolism is limited. We can only generate so much energy in a day. So if you try to, you know, go way beyond that, you're not burning more calories. You're just taking calories away from other areas that may need it. So it's just a different way of looking at, you know, how do we actually choose activity levels, how much training is appropriate. And if we go above a certain threshold, you know, maybe we're actually shooting ourselves in the foot because we don't have enough energy left over to recover faster or to be able to see the gains of our hard work. So it's an important concept just because it shows us how everything is linked.
Mm. It always reminded me of, we used to watch Rich Froning videos, who's like God of CrossFit. And he used to train like 8 hours in the day. And one thing they used to always talk about is he doesn't really eat that much food. And I would always be shocked that he eats like about similar amounts of what I eat in a day, from what I could see. But he was training 8 hours. But I guess it kind of makes sense. Like, regardless if he's training 3 hours or 8 hours, how much he eats is going to be just basically worked out of, you know, how big he is and how much muscle mass he's carrying.
I would actually bet you, too, in the times where he's not training, he's probably not doing anything. He's probably just sitting around. And that's actually something, if you've ever been around a pro bodybuilder, those guys basically lift weights and then sit at it and do nothing. Mm. Like, they just don't burn any calories in between their workouts. They just sit on the damn couch and they sleep. You know, they're trying to conserve energy, and they just don't have the energy to go out. And they're not out there walking 10 miles a day. They're literally just sitting on their couch and lifting a bunch of weights. Because if you will take away from muscle building, you will take away from strength gains if you're training 8 hours a day and you're out there walking around and doing a bunch of activity in between those liftings.
Mm. So how do you integrate that with like your training protocols? Like, how did that change as you started to learn more about this and these studies? What changes did you make to some of the training that you were prescribing?
You know, I started focusing even more on figuring out how can we use training not just to build fitness up, but to actually stimulate recovery. Because basically that's what you realize is when your body is training, you're breaking down tissue, you're stimulating it and telling it, hey, I need to get better, bigger and stronger and faster and all these sorts of things. But unless you actually drive energy into recovery, that those processes never actually happen. You have to actually make sure there's enough energy left over for the body to get better, right? To build new muscle tissue or to build new cardiovascular tissue or whatever. Those things that we consider fitness take a lot of energy as well. So I started looking a lot more at how can we use training to stimulate recovery and not just to stimulate fatigue and cause the body to break down, but how do we actually use training to rebuild the body and shuttle energy more into recovery? And that's something I've been doing for a number of years in some sense. But the more you dig into that theory, the more you look at the data from HRV and other you know, technologies out there, the more you realize, you know, if you've only got so many calories a day to work with and you're putting them all into activity and you're putting them all into mental stress, you're putting them all into training, then ultimately there's just not enough left over to go into recovery and you don't actually get better even though you're doing the work. So it just kind of caused me to look, you know, a bit deeper at how do we use training? How do we use different tools and technologies to get the most out of not just training, but also the recovery side of things? And if you look at, you know, why do people use drugs? What do drugs do? Drugs speed up recovery. Drugs are anabolic. They shift the body into a deeper level of recovery. And so I started looking just at how can we put together training programs that have recovery and have an emphasis on recovery. And ultimately you find people get better results when you put your time and effort into recovery, just like you do into the actual training side of things.
Mm. And so is recovery can mean lots of things. Obviously it can mean nutrition, supplementation, sleep, massage, all that sort of stuff. But what are the general principles and that you guide your athletes with when it comes to their recovery? Are you prescribing more training?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a few things. I think people tend to think of recovery as a very passive process. They think of recovery as just like laying around the couch or getting enough sleep or eating enough food, which is certainly a part of it. But I started developing a way to actually use training. It's simply a matter of the exercise selection, the type of methods we use, focusing on breathing and some postural stuff, using concentric based exercises, keeping the intensity appropriate, the time we try to keep them 30 to 45 minutes. So I created what I call rebound training workouts, which, you know, it's just like it sounds. It's rebounding your body into recovery. And we start using HRV to figure out what are the right ways to shift our body into that recovery state to get our recovery, you know, jump started more or less. And so like I said, I just call it rebound training. It's just a specific protocol I developed over the last couple of years of how to get in the gym, 30 to 45 minute workouts, go through the specific protocol. And then by the end, you know, you should see that your body is jump started its recovery process. And you typically, the measuring stick is, do I feel better? Do I walk out of the gym feeling more energized, feeling looser, feeling better? If you do that, typically you'll see that people's HRV and other numbers will reflect that the recovery is going to be accelerated the next few hours or over the next day. And it's a much different feeling than if you go in there and crush yourself. You feel tired and you feel like you just, you know, did a hard workout. Those are different feelings. Those are different stimulus for the body. So, you know, my goal now is to recognize or help people recognize the difference, right? You should go in the gym, you know, 3-4 times a week and break yourself down and stimulate the body to get better. But you should also go in 1-2 times a week and stimulate recovery so they can actually see the gains and see the benefits of those harder workouts. And so, you know, it's really just helping people realize that recovery doesn't have to be just laying around doing nothing, that we can actually use forms of training and we can be much more proactive in our approach to recovering and getting more out of our workouts.
Mm. So you use the rebound training as a dose to kickstart the recovery process, are you then taking advantage of those heightened processes by trying to consume more energy, like more high quality foods and potentially taking like a sleep or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're basically trying to shift your body has different states it can be in, right? And we can fundamentally measure it or look at it through the autonomic nervous system. That's what heart rate variability shows us. If you see low heart rate variability, we see basically a catabolic state. We're breaking stuff down. If we see a higher HRV, we're seeing more of an anabolic state. We're rebuilding tissue, right? And so our goal is to get our body into that anabolic state. And then, of course, we want to feed, you know, amino acids and enough carbohydrates and good quality nutrients to it so they can take those things and store them in the form of muscle tissue or the form of cardiovascular tissue and essentially see the gains that we're trying to achieve. Because remember, fitness is always going to be catabolic when you're training, but then hopefully anabolic in between those times, because that's where the building up come from. That's what anabolic is. Mm-hmm. So we just want to use training not just as a catabolic tool, but as an anabolic rebound training tool to get our body into that state. And then, yes, of course, you want to shuttle amino acids. You want to make sure your glycogen stores are full. You want to make sure it's not missing nutrients the body needs to rebuild these tissues. You want to make sure that you're not stressed out all the time, because that's going to knock you out of that state. So, there's a lot of things that go into it, but the underlying goal or the idea, like I said, is how can we get our body into that recovery state faster, sooner, and keep it there? And then when it is in that state, how do we maximize that?
Mm. And how big is breathing protocol as a part of that? I know you just touched on it, but for us, what we found is quite an interesting process. Some of our coaches have been playing it around with it because we live in, you know, a very urbanized part of Australia. It's obviously very stressful. Everyone's, you know, there's a lot of traffic. People got very stressful jobs. They do big hours. You know, they have deadlines. You know, you can imagine all this stuff. Very different to the state in which an athlete can train, where their only focus is training for the day, and they can go home and they can recover and sleep and not stress. How do you use like breath training and breathing to help mitigate some of that stress and start the recovery process? What we've noticed is if we do a bit more breathing before the start of a session and after a session, like we can help with the state change a lot more, because what we were finding is we would ramp people up so much with the training that then you send them off to work and, you know, work is go, go, go. And then by the time they hit, they clock out, they go home. Obviously they haven't spoke to their partner, or they got to get dinner. They got to speak to their kids. Right. And then that's more stress, even though it's, you know, it's family time. It's still stressful. They know they got to get to bed soon. That's kind of stressful because you got to wake up early to get back into the training, and that compounding effect over months and months leads to, you know, some kind of breakdown, some kind of injury, them just being too mentally fatigued. How do you use breath work with the recovery process?
Yeah, so, you know, like you said, there's a series of things that we do. Number one, I agree with you, the same thing. There's a recovery protocol for the warm-up and for the cool-down, and making sure that people's breath and they're learning how to control their breath as a part of their training, so that by the time they walk out of that gym, you want their heart rate to be as close to the heart rate they had when they came into the gym. If they can get it down there through breathing drills and breathing techniques, then you know that they've essentially shut off that sympathetic system. And they're in that recovery, they're headed towards that recovery state at least. The second thing is, I do a lot of stuff with the conditioning exercise, the conditioning drills, which I didn't really talk about ultimately conditioning because it was so many years ago. But you can teach people how to control their heart rate through conditioning methods and conditioning exercises. So a lot of people focus right now, they do their conditioning on just driving their heart rate as high as they can, as fast as they can, or whatever. But what they should actually be learning how to do is control their heart rates at different levels, and then to also let the heart rate come down and control that recovery as quickly as possible. So the in-between repetitions of conditioning is just as important as, you know, the repetitions themselves. So a big part of what I teach now and work on with different people is learning how to control your heart rate. So instead of just saying, hey, I want you to, you know, get up to 180 or whatever, it's I want you to get up to 180, control it there for 30 seconds, and I want you to learn how to drop it to 130 as quickly as possible through breathing, through positional, through mental relaxation, through visualization, through all these things. Hmm. If you can teach people how to control their breathing and control their heart rate, what you're really doing is teach them how to control their stress response. So if somebody can learn that through training, now they're sitting there in traffic, and rather than getting upset and frustrated that somebody has cut them off or they're trying to get home, if they can literally learn how to control that stress response and keep their heart rate from spiking because they're pissed off, that will translate into lower and lower levels of stress and better recovery and better, you know, everything. So I think you have to use the workout itself as a tool, not just develop fitness, but develop some skill sets, which are, you know, heart rate control. I call it dynamic energy control, but just teaching people, how do I control my stress response? How do I control my heart rate? How do I control my recovery? And you can consciously control a lot of those things just by teaching people how to do it properly through conditioning work, not just the warm-up and the cool-down, but the actual conditioning work as well.
So is a lot of your conditioning work with heart rate monitors?
Pretty much everything at this point, yeah, honestly. It's heart rate monitors are the single best tool because it's your feedback, right? It's you can't really teach somebody how to control it if you can't see what it is in the first place. Hmm. So my new app Morpheus shows your heart rate, and we use a lot of stuff where you're going up into one zone and coming back into another zone. But yeah, you've got to be able to see what your heart rate is so that you can learn and get better at actually controlling it. You'll find that when people first start doing it, they tend to suck at it because they've never actually seen how difficult it can be to bring the heart rate back down consciously. But once you start practicing it and you try different levels and different drills we put together, you'll see people get much, much better quickly at being able to control their heart rate. They can get it up, they can get it down, they can put it where they want it, and they can learn exactly how how much exertion it takes to get it up there, and they can learn how to control it and bring it back down. It's like I said, it's a whole skill set. I think we need to stop thinking about conditioning purely in terms of a fitness level. We need to look at conditioning also in terms of a skill set that you have to master in order to be really well-conditioned. And if you look at the athletes that are well-conditioned, it's not always because they have amazing VO2 or amazing threshold or, you know, amazing fitness numbers. It's also often because they know how to control their energy better. They know how to control when to, you know, when to go hard, when to rest, when to put those things together. And it's a skill that has to be learned as part of conditioning as well. So for your average Gen Pop client, you know, the carryover is like I said, it's the skill teaches them how to relax and how to control their energy expenditure in life and not deal with people's cutting them off or deadlines or whatever and be stressed out about them. They can learn how to shut some of that response off.
Mm. Yeah, I think I had read an article of yours once, and you were talking about, I can't remember the exact term for it, but you were talking about the, I think it was the difference between like maybe your resting heart rate and your max heart rate is like a good indicator of fitness, or maybe it was some other thing like that. But can you talk about the different zones and like what they should be for individuals and how much they should work within those different zones? Because obviously a lot of people believe these days, and marketing will have them believe that, you know, I watch shows in Australia where in England, all they talk about is high intensity training because, you know, it's so fantastic. You can do 5 minutes of exercise a week and you don't have to, you know, you can get all the health benefits that you would if you went long, slow distance. But obviously they miss the benefits of, you know, sitting between 120 and 130 than they do just being at 180 for 180, 190 for, you know, 5 minutes. So how much, like, what are the different zones that you would prescribe for people, and like how much time do they need to be spending in them per week?
Yeah, I mean, it really just kind of depends on person's fitness level, but you know, I define zones a bit differently than most people these days. I think people tend to look at too many zones, it just gets confusing. So the way I use zones now, I have, like I said, my new app, we have three basic zones. We have what we call your overload zone, which is you know, typically 90% of your max and above. We have your conditioning zone, which is usually somewhere between about, you know, 80 to 90% or lower 90s, then you'd have kind of your recovery zone, which is usually below that. And I tend to use those three zones. And the reality is, you know, most people should spend no more than, I would say, 10 to, you know, 15% of their time in that 90% and above range. Because, yes, when you train high intensity, you get fast results, but you also get fast overtraining and fast plateaus and fast injuries, right? So that you can't train it the highest level of intensity every day without suffering the consequences.
Yeah.
And the reality is you've got to balance that out. So I would say most people should spend, you know, like I said, maybe 10, 15% the most of that above 90%. And then the rest should be spread out with a mixture of that lower, what I would call like the recovery or low end conditioning, which is where cardiac output and all those things happen. And then, you know, another third of that should be kind of in the middle there or more of that, you know, 85, 88, 99, somewhere in those percentages. But those also change a bit each day. If you're really fatigued, those numbers are going to be different than if you're well recovered. So, you know, it's a long-winded answer, but the reality is most people spend way too much time in the high intensity and not enough time in kind of the lower and moderate intensities. If you look at most research out there, they look at endurance athletes and they look at people that are, you know, have high aerobic fitness, which is the cornerstone of conditioning. They see about 80-20. So 80% kind of low to moderate intensity and 20% high intensity. And I would say that's actually a good rule of thumb. And the way I kind translate that in the real world for most people is no more than about twice a week of what I would call true high intensity, which again, I would say for most average people above 90% of your maximum heart rate, if you spend twice a week, you know, maybe 20 minutes, you know, in that high intensity above 90%, that's what most people can handle well. If you start going four times a week or you try to do 45 minutes of that, ultimately they're going to pay the price. Now, if you're talking about an athlete who's a full-time athlete and they have great genetics and they have the rest and the recovery and the food, then yeah, they can handle more. But your average person twice a week of truly high intensity work is about all someone's going to be able to benefit from and all they're really going to be able to recover from in the long run. So I call that red line training, you know, twice a week of red line training, a couple of times a week of more rebound recovery training, and then a couple of days in the week of somewhere in between is what, you know, most people are going to tolerate and see the best results from.
Mm. And when you're prescribing the three zones, or what are the, are you limiting the different movements that can be done within them? Because I think that I don't know if you saw it circulating recently, but Farah Sahabi was on Joe Rogan's podcast, and he took a big swing at CrossFit in the podcast. We may or may not have swung back, and we may have gotten to a bit of an internet war, and we'll probably chat with him later. But that aside, it was more, I think his concern was that people are in that high-end red line zone and they're doing movements which maybe shouldn't be in that zone. So, for example, Olympic lifting or gymnastics, which I can understand, definitely for sure. For the general pop, I agree as well. I think he was referencing more for athletes. I think it's different because athletes, like you said, can adapt a lot better and obviously have a lot, you know, more time to work on these skills, and so they can do more complex things at higher intensities. But obviously at high intensities, you bring up the danger level in terms of, you know, loss of motor control and obviously people doing silly things under fatigue. So are you limiting, like, are you saying, okay, if we're going to hit that zone, we only do, you know, the bike, like the assault bike, or we only do bodyweight movements, burpees or sprints or that sort of thing? Or are you incorporating all kinds of modalities into all different zones?
I would say it depends on the person you're working with and the goal, right? So if it is an athlete and they have to learn how to perform in those higher intensities, then you want to develop the point where they can maintain their technique at those high intensity zones. I think that's actually something that's very overlooked these days, is if we're training high intensity, again, we don't want to just train the fitness. We want to train the skill. And part of the skill is, how can I maintain my technique even when I'm tired? And that's what people miss. Part of conditioning is not just getting your heart rate up as high as you can. It's being able to perform your movements and your technique correctly even when you are at those high heart rates. So, for example, a combat athlete needs to get their heart rates up there, but they shouldn't just be swinging away as hard and as fast as they can. They should be able to maintain their technique at those high intensity zones, right? So, you know, I think if you're training an athlete, you have to be mindful of the movements, but you should also be coaching the movements as people fatigue. That's part of conditioning. Yeah. If you're talking about your general population person, then yeah, it's always a risk reward. I want to make sure that they're doing things that are safe when they're in their higher intensities. But as you progress their fitness levels, you can get into more and more varied movements. I think the biggest thing, again, people have this misconception that I'm just trying to drive their heart rate as high as possible to make their conditioning better. No, you need to also improve their movement quality as part of their conditioning, because what's conditioning but movement efficiency? The more efficiently you can move, the longer you can move for. It's not just how high can you get your heart rate, it's how well can you maintain your movement quality as your heart rates increase or as the intensity increases. So I would say whatever movements you're choosing, if someone's fitness level is lower, then choose simpler movements so they can develop that qualities as they progress. Then yeah, you can increase the complexity of the movements. You can increase how challenging the movements are. I would just say it depends on, you know, the person you're working with. There's no reason someone can't do complex movements at high intensities, but if they can't even do the basics at high intensity, then start there first, right? It just depends on what level of person you're talking with. I mean, I wouldn't take somebody who's never cleaned and jerk and have them clean and jerk for 30 seconds as fast as they possibly can, because they can't do it properly even at low intensities, right? So why would they need to do it at high intensities and fatigue? So it's just a progression. I would say, you know, everything should be in a progression. If somebody can do a movement well at low and moderate intensities, then there's no reason they can't do it at high intensities. But if they can't even do those things, then you have no business throwing them into a high intensity version of that movement. It's got to be a progression.
Hmm. Yeah, no, it's a good way of putting it. Mm. Very well put.
It does also mean, I think, if you're doing CrossFit, you know, if you can only do the really high intensity stuff once or twice a week, it does seem like you really do need to put the movements in there most of the time. Yeah. So otherwise, you're just never going to get the practice at those high intensity.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, absolutely. I mean, you got to realize in CrossFit, the movements are the skill, right? So you've got to train those movements in a variety of intensities. And I actually think if you look at some of the guys that do really well at CrossFit, they're incredibly efficient in their movements at even as they fatigue, right? They don't look like shit. They still actually have reasonably good technique as they get tired. And part of that is just training themselves to maintain that technique as they tire. And that's part of how you can keep going. I think people, again, if you let yourself get sloppy as you get tired, you're just going to get more tired. If you recognize you're fatiguing and you're able to control your technique and control your energy expenditure, you're ultimately going to be able to do more reps and maintain that. So again, that's part of the skill set that should be taught as part of conditioning. Too many people look at conditioning purely as a fitness, purely as making somebody really tired to make your conditioning better. Bullshit. Making you move better for longer is how your conditioning is going to improve. And there's a skill that's involved in that. It's not literally just get as tired as you can equals conditioning. It's never that simple.
that is how people perceive they will get better fitness, how sloppy they can get at the end. Yeah, it's like when
you
always see like a panic response at the higher intensities that I always notice in people, and that always takes them from you can maintain this for another 5 minutes to, you need to go sit down for the next 5 minutes, because they basically get to a state where they become so fatigued that they begin to panic. Then, and they be, you see it in their face. You see the angst and the stress, and you see their breathing get shallower, them basically tighten up on their movement, and they panic. They just can't. They fatigue so fast at that end point, which is kind of like the point when theoretically they do want to be there. They want to be at that high intensity because that's the feeling they like, but they just panic for whatever reason when they get there, because I don't know, we haven't taught them long enough, or to kind of learn to relax in that zone or be more
exactly efficient. It's because they haven't been taught the right response. The body's normal response to extreme fatigue is stop doing what the hell you're doing. That's what we're hardwired to do, right? It's a protective mechanism because the body's not designed to blow itself apart. So it's a matter of, again, progression and teaching people how to deal with different levels of fatigue and different levels of intensity and how to respond appropriately and to be able to have the correct response, where instead of just falling apart mentally or physically, you can take a breath, recognize your limitation, where you're at, and keep progressing, you know, intelligently through, and to keep doing what you're doing, but to do it in a mechanically efficient way. That's the skill. That's what we need to teach people. We need to teach people to recognize their fatigue levels, recognize how their, you know, what their body's normal response is, and then overcome that, right? If a fighter always drops his hands as he gets tired, rather than just making him really tired, letting him drop his hands, we need to slowly coach him to not let that happen or to recognize when that happens. Same thing with lifting. If, you know, someone's squat technique completely falls apart as soon as they get tired, we need to make them aware that that's what they tend to do and have the correct response to prevent that from happening or to adjust when they feel themselves getting tired. I mean, people's perception of fatigue needs to be more nuanced. I think right now it's like, oh shit, I'm tired, fall apart. I mean, they need to be able to recognize what they do when they get tired. They need to recognize how to avoid falling apart when they get tired. And again, I think that's just, it's part of coaching. It's part of being able to realize, again, the goal is not just make people tired. The goal is teach people how to react to being tired and how to move properly when they're tired and how to respond to the situations where they're tired. That's where the art and science of coaching should be. It's not just make someone tired and call it good.
I think you've been an advocate for a while of water training for some recovery stuff and some breathing stuff. I believe that was some stuff I read out of your account. Do you still?
Yeah, we still do a lot of 2 days a week, usually of swimming. You know, particularly for combat athletes or athletes that take a pounding to their joints. You know, we just found it's much easier on the body than obviously doing a bunch of high intensity sprints. It's, you know, if you're going to be doing things for athletes that are less specific anyway, like, you know, sprinting is not particularly specific to fighting, so why not use some swimming there, which is also less specific to fighting but much easier in the body. We've also found just being in the water tends to promote recovery, blood flow, you know, all sorts of things. So yeah, I think just the water in general and water training is a good tool, particularly for athletes, but for other people too. Most people can get the fitness benefits of it without putting as much wear and tear in their body, which, you know, has benefits.
We had someone on the podcast a while ago talk about how they started doing some really, really intense breath training in the pool, and to the point where they did it on one day and they were pretty new to it and it was really hard. And then the next day they came back to do, or maybe within 2 days, they came back to do that same protocol, but they couldn't do it as long. And the swim coach that was there was explaining to them that what had done is they actually damaged their lungs a bit because of the intensity at which they were trying, or the oxygen debt they were putting themselves in. And then they had to wait for their lungs to recover and repair themselves to kind of get the adaptation from the first protocol of the swimming. Have you heard of that stuff before?
I mean, I haven't looked too much into that level of what the adaptations are, but there's no doubt. I mean, holding your breath and having a challenge to the lungs could certainly cause fatigue or soreness the same way that it does with any other muscle, right? There's respiratory muscles that are part of what drives respiration. So those respiratory muscles themselves could certainly be fatigued and could certainly be a part of why you can't hold your breath or why you couldn't perform the same. So I don't know that we did tend to not push it quite to the extreme. You're noticeably worse the next day or next second day, yeah. Or whatever, because we're not swimmers, but it would make sense to me intuitively that as you train something, you're going to see some fatigue in it in the process, and respiration incorporates a lot of musculature and incorporates lung tissue and all those sorts of things. So there's certainly could be some validity to that idea that, look, if you go high intensity and your breath holding everything else, then you absolutely could see the fatiguing effects of that. I mean, a diver would probably tell you that better than I would be able to, what that looks like. But I'm sure, just intuitively, you know, anytime you stress the body, you can see fatigue, and that's part of what the healing process looks like. So it's certainly possible, yeah.
Mm. Do you use the, like on that sort of breath topic, do you use the training mask or the altitude masks that have been going around?
The Bane mask.
Yeah.
No, I think honestly, in general, we want to teach athletes how to breathe properly throughout their exercise. We want them to drive as much oxygen into their lungs and into their body as possible, because the more they can do that, then the more they can, you know, perform effectively. I think teaching people how to breathe, restricted breathing, tends to limit their oxygen in a way that I don't think is necessarily beneficial. If they want to, you know, train respiratory function, there's better ways to do it than that, than training. I think typically you see people do it, their training quality just goes to shit. You see their technique fall apart. You see they're much weaker. I mean, I think the funny thing is that the research shows, you know, train low, live high. Like, that's what the model actually shows, of training in a highly oxygenated environment, but living in a less oxygenated environment, because you can see some of the oxygenation benefits from doing that. But I don't think the masks themselves are simulating L2 in the slightest. They're just restricting your breathing and tend to make your technique worse, in my experience.
Mm. Yeah, I think some coaches that are advocates of it have generally prescribed it outside of training for just general breath work to help people put more of a focus on what their respiratory muscles are doing during, you know, at the process of meditation or yoga or that sort of thing. So really low intensity work to bring the absolute focus on their breathing. It's generally how we've seen it being prescribed.
You would, yeah, I mean, I think it's valid.
Yeah.
What was that?
You need a very flexible job to be able to wear that during the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. And I think the PRI stuff, you know, posture respiration, some of the breathing stuff that I have on my site with Mike Robertson and Bill Hartman, I think there's more value in learning how to breathe through those different techniques than I would say with an external device, honestly.
Mm. Yeah. It's yeah, I don't know. I don't know how benefit, if it was that good, then everyone would be wearing it, but not everyone's wearing it. And usually the people that are elite athletes that are wearing it have a promo code. So that's always something to be a bit sus about.
Yeah, if you're getting paid to wear it, then that's one thing. But I think the problem is it makes conditioning seem, again, like it's simpler than it actually is, or that it takes away the idea that technique is an important part of conditioning. Because if your fitness is great, but your technique is garbage, and you've ruined your movement quality because you're putting a mask on that's affecting your ability to train properly, then who cares? I mean, movement and movement quality and skill are just as important qualities as fitness. So you can't sacrifice one for the other.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if you're familiar with a researcher, Dr. Andy Galpin. He's been a guest on the show a few times, but he put out some research recently that he'd been doing in his lab. Now, I can't remember the exact name of the lab, but it's at a university in the States.
Yeah, he's down in California.
Oh, you're familiar with his stuff?
Yeah, I know Andy well.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, he put something out recently about he's like, look, it's nothing set in stone yet, like all research, but there was some early stuff to suggest that caffeine and high intensity training may, obviously the caffeine is going to increase your abilities in the session, but is going to blunt the adaptation from the session. Did you see his post about that?
No, I didn't actually. I'll have to ask him about it though, because I mean, it's interesting. There's some research on even like vitamin C blunting some of the effects of endurance training, because it may blunt some of the stimulus. And so it's fascinating stuff to see exactly how that all plays out. I haven't seen that one particular. I'll have to ask him about it. Mm. But you know, it's possible. Literally, just anything that can increase performance by decreasing some of the stress could theoretically blunt some of the benefits, because it's blunting some of the stress, right? Like, if your performance is increasing, maybe it's because it's less stressful to the body, which seems great from a performance standpoint. But if it's less stressful, then it could be causing less of a trigger to tell the body to make itself better. So, you know, intuitively, I think there's reasons that stuff like that can happen. And like I said, there's research out there that just doing a gram of vitamin C before your endurance workout actually blunted some of the signaling that came from the endurance work. So there's I think a lot of unanswered questions in the area. So I haven't seen that one in particular. I'll have to ask him about that, but that's certainly interesting and valuable. No, if that's the case, it would certainly have you know, some pretty strong implications of avoiding caffeine and stimulants before your workouts, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And that's sort of the conversation I want to touch on, or the topic. What supplements are you recommending for people to enhance conditioning? Probably the most popular one is the beetroot powder, the nitric oxide and stuff. And then obviously beta-alanine is one thing as well that is very popular for improving sort of your threshold. Do you have any like prescriptions around supplements that you recommend for people with conditioning?
I think those, as far as just general endurance kind of stuff goes, the ones you mentioned are probably the most well-researched and discussed out there. I like some stuff that supports mitochondrial function. So there's a couple products by a company called Design for Health. Mitochondrial NRG is a good one. There's a company called Niagen that makes I can't think of the actual chemical name off the top of my head right now, but it's another one that's aimed more at energy production. So there's some I've looked at that are kind of more specifically designed just for mitochondrial function. And I think if you can improve mitochondrial function, you can improve just kind of the overall aerobic capacity. So certainly some there and some kind of unconventional ones. I actually like some of the brain supplements, maybe not specifically for conditioning per se, but more about the mental demanding side of it. So choline, I think, is a really important one in there. You're getting some good source of choline. You can get in some of the nootropics, which I don't know what different countries have different regulations, but like the piracetams and some of the racetams, some of those can be really useful.
Useful in what sense?
What's that?
Useful. How have you seen them benefit your
just because I think some of them can promote blood flow into the brain, and at high intensity exercises, blood flow in the brain can be one of the limiting factors in terms of if blood flow of the brain gets, I won't say limited, but as blood flow of the brain gets restricted, because you only have so much oxygen to go around, right?
Yeah.
And your brain's always going to preserve oxygen to itself, to the brain, before it's going to preserve oxygen to the muscles. So as more oxygenation starts going to the brain, it's going to take away from other areas. And there's some research that some of these supplements, as far as nootropics, can drive more oxygen into the brain and increase oxygenation at the brain level. So in my experience, some of those supplements that can facilitate some of that can actually help improve your ability to tolerate higher intensities and be able to think clearly and be able to cognitively process, you know, movements and responses and coaching at higher intensities. So it's, again, it's kind of a different area than most people would think of, but I think some of the brain cognitive functional supplements can be beneficial for conditioning and being able to process those things. We could, again, it's a much different way than most people would look at it, but I've seen people have good benefits, and it's something I've played around a lot with myself over the years. So like I said, some of the cholines, some of the racetams, some of the other nootropics that are out there, I've seen actually have a pretty beneficial effect on brain function, and again translate into learning and being able to function at higher intensities and higher levels.
Do you stack them together or you just use them in isolation?
I usually stack them, but again, you have to be, the thing about nootropics is people respond very differently to different doses. Yeah. And they can have a U-shaped response curve. So if you do too much, you can actually make yourself kind of worse. So you can kind of start out just a real basic of, you know, maybe just a good choline and a piracetam is probably the simplest of all, you know, stacks there is. Just those two start there. And then there's literally hundreds of them that you can get into. So you really got to personalize when it comes to any sort of brain functional stuff. Because, again, the right dose for one person can make somebody else groggy and actually worse off. So start really simple, start low doses and gradually increase, and also check. I mean, some organizations out there ban them, so you gotta be real careful and make sure that if you're, you know, working with an athlete, that you're not taking anything that is not allowed to be taken. But piracetam, deprenyl, choline, all these sorts of things, I think if you aren't in any sort of organization where those are a problem, they can actually be a very useful tool for higher intensity stuff and being able to learn and cognitively function at high levels.
And have you measured those, like when you take those, or when your athletes take them with HRV, like does it change the HRV signaling and like the response you get?
Not a whole lot, honestly. No, it's a more subtle effect than I think a direct fitness measure. Again, it's more of just, I think you can accelerate people's learning and you can accelerate their movement control at higher intensity, which is probably, you know, a more indirect gauge of their conditioning or how they're going to improve their conditioning. So I don't know that you'd see a fitness marker like HRV as much as you'd see people be able to adapt better or to learn at high intensities or to just push themselves at higher intensities and be able to still function well. So it's a bit of a different take on it, like I said, but I've seen success with myself and with athletes I've worked with for sure.
Mm. Have you seen caffeine affect HRV?
Yeah, caffeine definitely affects it. Any sort of stimulant that gets the sympathetic system going is going to lower HRV to some extent.
Right.
It could even be as simple as something like that, right? Maybe if we increase sympathetic drive during the workout and we, you know, do that, then maybe it takes longer for the parasympathetic system to kick in, and that that could blunt some of the effectiveness of the workout. Who knows what's causing the stuff that Andy's seeing, or if there's multiple things going on there at once. Who knows? There's lots of potential avenues.
So are you limiting, or like just knowing that sort of stuff, do you limit the caffeine intake? Generally, are you prescribing a lower amount of caffeine? If someone, Gen Pop and athletes, are asking you about it, how much should I drink? When should I have it? Blah, blah, blah. I know obviously the UFC has regulations on how much you can have in your system and that sort of thing. So are you being careful with it because of, you know, the sympathetic drive it can
promote? I'm generally speaking hesitant to tell people to take much caffeine at all. I think people live, I don't know about your country, but I live in Seattle where everybody lives on Starbucks. And I think it's definitely it's got more negative possibilities than it does positive ones, because again, if you're constantly stimulating that sympathetic system, then you're keeping your parasympathetic system turned off to some extent. You're decreasing your recovery because you're always in a sympathetic state. And it can improve, it can, you know, have an effect on your sleep quality. It can have an effect on just your recovery. It can have an effect on a lot of things. So I think people over stimulate themselves for sure these days. So I try to tell people, you know, 100 milligrams a day or less of caffeine if possible for your average person. Now, if somebody's, you know, high level athlete and they seem to tolerate well, maybe slightly more than that. But I tend to err on the side of caution. I think less caffeine is better than more. And I personally don't drink coffee or have much in the way of stimulants at all. So I think it's definitely an area that a lot of your average person could improve. And if you see that person that just lives on coffee or caffeine, chances are their HIV is low. They're at risk for cardiovascular disease, and they're going to suffer the consequences at some point.
How do you have any like stories of maybe potentially where the HIV has been extremely useful for certain athletes? Because I feel like some people at the gym, I swear if I strap the HIV monitor on them, I wouldn't let them train for like 2 weeks.
Well, you know, again, I think it's more of where that becomes useful is making people aware of the effectiveness of what they're, the effects of what they're doing, right? Like, you know, I'll give you an example. I had a guy, he was just a Microsoft executive. And he's a really high-level Microsoft executive, makes lots and lots of money, and played competitive volleyball. And he played competitive volleyball on the weekends and worked 80 hours during the week. And he came to me because he wanted to increase his vertical jump. And, you know, I started looking at some of his numbers. And for he was in his 40s. For a guy in his 40s, he actually moved pretty well. And so, you know, we started doing some training, and then I gave him some HRV. I'm like, what the hell's going on with this guy? You know, I mean, is work killing him? What's going on? So I had him write down his diet. The guy was drinking 20 to 24 cans of Coke a day, because his office was literally right next to the vending machine. And at Microsoft, all the food is free. So he just literally would drink one can of Coke to the next all day long.
Oh my God. Just be clearing out that vending machine every fucking day.
Yeah, pretty much. It's free, right? So once he actually, I was like, look at your HRV, you know, and so he just had him stop for a brief period of time, and his HRV shot up like 10 points, right? So it was this immediate, like, holy shit, he'd never realized just what actually it was doing to him. You know, he had no comprehension until he saw that actual number there. So, you know, if you had an athlete who shouldn't train for 2 weeks, you know, rather than saying, hey, just don't worry about it, just keep training, I would say, why? Like, what the hell are you doing to yourself that's causing this to happen? I'd rather fix the ignorance and figure out what the hell is causing it than just say, well, your recovery is shit, so we're just going to keep training anyway. I tend to think more information is better than less. I would tend to say that, you know, if someone shouldn't be training, then figure out why they shouldn't be training and fix it, versus just saying, no, you don't want to know, keep going. So I think there's a lot of value in showing people the truth about what they're doing themselves, because again, people a lot of times just don't recognize how the things they're doing to themselves are affecting them. And when you can actually show them numbers of how much sleep screws up their training, how much drinking screws up their training, you know, how much just being up late for a few nights and not you know, not being able to shut off that stress response. I mean, there's so many things that people do outside the gym that have way bigger impact on what they should be doing inside the gym. They have no idea until they can actually see those numbers on a screen. Then they start to figure it out.
Yeah, it's like so many people have just carried across the bad habits that they've picked up in their younger years where they were able to tolerate that amount of stress. So whether it's like staying out late and drinking a lot or whatever and still have a six pack, you know, in college. And it's just like, you can't do those same things in your 30s. Like, it just, the body does not have the resiliency that it had 10, 15 years ago. And that is, it's undoing those patterns that we find is like the real key to, you know, to people's long-term health and success. I mean, it's about, oh, you have to drink water every day. Like, you just can't pound coffee like from 6 a.m. onwards. Like, you have to drink water. Like, just basic shit like that. Go to bed at the same time every single day. Like, they're just not used to that sort of stuff. And it's not because they're ignorant. It's just because they've carried those bad patterns for just such a long time.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And when we started selling Morpheus last year, we asked people when they bought, what was the biggest reason you ordered Morpheus, our recovery system? And 9 times out of 10, it was like, oh, as I've gotten older, I've noticed my recovery slowing down. I don't get back as the gym as quickly, or I feel myself just not recovering as well. Like they start to notice the effects of it, but they're not necessarily sure what to do about it, right? Like they can feel themselves being more sore, being more tired, not quite getting the same results, maybe getting a little fatter. So they recognize there's something different as they age. But like you said, I think they just don't fundamentally realize, like, hey, these are the things you've got to do to fix this. Because if you don't, you know, you can't rebound the same way you could when you're 20. And the things you're doing are having a much bigger impact now than they did 10 years ago.
Mm. Yeah. I was just going to say, how have you found, just switching gears a little bit, moving from the different fields in business? I mean, you've done the in-face person-to-person coaching, you know, owning a gym. Obviously, that's a whole beast in itself. And then you've obviously gone online and done a lot of stuff online. And then you've obviously built the Bioforce and the Morpheus more recently. How do you balance all that out? And like, what, can you walk us through that journey a little bit? How you kind of made the different transitions and kind of where you're at with it now?
Yeah, I mean, so I started my gym in 2003. I was 23 years old and really didn't know half of what I was doing for the most part. But I started training combat athletes and NFL football players. And the funny thing was, you know, that's kind of who I thought my market needed to be successful. Mm. And then you kind of realize early on, like, wait a minute, NFL football players don't really want to pay you because they think everything should be free. And they're only in town for a few months out of the year.
Yeah.
And the time fighters made no money. This is back in, you know, 2003, the fighters I was training were making next to nothing. So I quickly kind of realized, like, this actually isn't a very good way to build a gym. I was broke, you know, for most part of my early few years running the gym, because again, the clients I was training were high level athletes that had no money or didn't want to pay me, the ones that did have money. And then 2006 came around, a funny thing happened. I ended up doing a volleyball clinic with a friend of mine at University of Washington, and this one volleyball clinic, we made like $10,000 in 2 days and had just a flood of volleyball players in the gym. And I realized, holy shit, like this is a whole new market that I could potentially start working with. And so I actually built, and people don't know this, I actually built most of my gym and the profitability of at least around volleyball and around youth sports, because those athletes, they, you know, they were inherently motivated to get better. Their parents had no problem paying the money for them. They were much more consistent. You know, I always trained general population clients, but then you realize general population clients, you know, were tricky too, because they had full schedules and busy lives, and they would train for a few weeks and they would leave and they wouldn't do the right things outside the gym. And
yeah,
you know, there was a lot of turnover with the general population clients. So, you know, I started training volleyball players, and that's where most of the profitability came in at the gym. And I still train combat athletes over the years, obviously, but the gym itself was built largely on volleyball and youth sports. Mm. And fast forward 2008, I launched 8 weeks out because I realized there was a need for combat sports conditioning, because there was just so much poor information out there. And I wrote Ultimate Mixed Conditioning kind of just to see what the response would be. And I figured there was a need. And so that kind of started my online career. And then that over the years just grew from, you know, Ultimate Mixed Conditioning into Bioforce, into my conditioning certification and Morpheus. And really what I've learned over the years is what makes people successful, whether it's in the business side on the gym or whether it's online, it's having a specific audience that you're talking to and having a specific message of how to help them solve their problems or achieve their goals or get better. I think too many people try to train anybody and everybody, and they don't really have anything that makes them unique or different. I think what made me successful early on is I had a very specific niche, right? I had MMA conditioning, and I had a specific market that, you know, wasn't really being served. There really wasn't that many people writing intelligently about MMA conditioning. Nobody was out there really giving good science-backed information about how to improve your conditioning for combat sports, or really most sports. So I think the journey I've gone through is just looking at how do I, you know, have the take information that I have and help people solve the problems that they have. And what I've found over the years is just, you know, speaking to specific groups of people who have specific problems and helping them solve them is the way to be successful, regardless of whether it's online or whether it's in the gym. Having a specific audience, knowing what your audience's problems are, knowing what your audience's challenges are, and then putting together products, services, information, programs, or whatever the case may be, that helps them reach their goals, solve their problems, and do it effectively is the key to success. And that's really kind of all I've ever done is find people that had problems, you know, whether it's combat athletes need to get in better condition, or it's volleyball players need to stay injury free in the club season, or whatever the case may be. It's really about, I think, have a specific audience, have a specific message, you know, become a real expert in something and then help people get better. Mm.
Did the, when you said you launched 8 weeks out, what did that, what was that? Was that like the first article? Was that the website? Had you pre-written a ton of blogs?
No. So it's the funniest, here's a funny story. I basically went on a site called SureDog, and for your readers who aren't, our listeners who aren't familiar, SureDog is basically the biggest MMA site out there.
Yeah.
At the time I had no website. I'd never written an article online. I was training volleyball athletes and I was training combat athletes. That was most who I was training at the time. And a few general pop, but I basically just went on a site and I was like, I wonder what people are talking about, you know, as far as MMA conditioning, because I really wasn't a big online forum guy. And I'd been training lots of world-class fighters up to this point for like 6 or 7 years by then. And all the information I saw on these forums was mostly just stupid. It was just not good information. So I created this post called How to Finally Solve Your Conditioning Problem. And I wrote basically some basic principles. And I said, look, here's how I think you should approach conditioning. Here's the reason all the things you guys are talking about here are dead wrong. And so what do you think happened? I got absolutely flamed and ripped apart. Everyone's like, this guy, fuck you. You know what you're talking about. Who are you, newbie, right? Like, that's my first, it was literally my first post, right? I'd never posted. And so I got flamed for like 3 pages long. And I could have either just said, all right, screw this, I'm done. Or I hate that. So I just basically came back online and I said, well, okay, let me tell you why you're all full of shit. And I started typing this big, you know, this big monologue out, and it essentially just turned into an argument for like 3 pages long or 4 pages. And then finally somebody jumped on and said, hey, by the way, this guy trains all these world champions. I never mentioned that. I never want to say here's who I trained, because at the time I was working with Pride. I was working with all kinds of world champions.
Right.
And no one knew that. Right. So eventually someone came on and said, hey, you guys might want to listen to this guy. Here's all the people he's worked with over the years. He worked with, you know, Matt Hume for many years.
Yeah.
And so then everyone's attitudes changed like instantly. And it basically turned into a whole different ball game. And I got all this attention and people were asking all these questions. And so it turned into this like 400 page thread with like, I think it was something like 500,000 views within a fairly short period of time. And so it just, jeez, turned into basically this monster. And so I was like, holy shit, I need to create a website. Right. I had never thought about it, but I'm like, I'm going to create a website. So I created 8 weeks out, and I literally just kind of cobbled together a forum. And I did this all myself at the time. I didn't know what I was doing, but I made this forum, and people all of a sudden started going to my forum and asked me questions there. And so then I was like, maybe I should write a book out of this. And so the funny thing was, I wrote half of Ultimate Conditioning. I wrote like the first few chapters, and then I put it for sale. And I was like, well, I don't want to finish this book if no one buys it, right? Yeah. So I basically said, oh, pre-order Ultimate Conditioning, $39 or whatever it was. And I had like 400 or 500 orders within a week. So I'm like, shit, now I got to finish this thing, right? And so yeah. I told people it's going to be done in 3 weeks, right? I'm thinking, oh, I can write the rest of it. Another. It took me 4 months. Wow. So people were really pissed off at that point, right? Yeah. Like, where's my damn book? You took my money. You told me 3 weeks. It's been 3 months, right? So I was getting just emails every day of pissed off people. And I'm like, no, it's work. It's almost done. It's almost done. It's almost done.
Yeah.
And so eventually the book came out, and you know, look, we still sell 1,000+ copies a year of that thing, even though it's been out since 2009. So everything worked out for the best, but it certainly was not some grand master plan of mine to ever go online. It really just kind of happened because I saw a need for it. And that one post really just opened up my eyes that people had no idea what they were doing when it came to conditioning. And I wanted to share the stuff that I was doing with all of our fighters at the time. So, you know, I literally just kind of created it out of response to people arguing with me. It was a funny thing.
Mm. I can just imagine all those people like, okay, I'm 12 weeks out from my fight. I'm going to order this book and then I'll be 8 weeks out.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, perfect. Oh yeah. I was not getting angry or happy emails, you know, that's for sure. But then, you know, the book came out and people liked it and read it, and it kept growing. So yeah, lesson number one is don't release a book when it's halfway done unless you fully realize it's going to take you another 3 or 4 months to finish it. I thought I could have it done in 3 weeks, but that was not the case.
Mm. Yeah, well, there you go. So that leads me to ask, what part of your week, day, week, year, month do you enjoy doing the most? You've obviously done a lot of stuff, you know, trained youth athletes on site, author, writing blogs, training, you know, the best fighters in the world.
Forum troll.
I'm sure the answer is probably doing a little bit of everything, but what have you found is like the happy medium? What do you kind of enjoy doing the most these days?
You know, I enjoy a mixture of stuff. Like you said, I enjoy still working with people that I know are, you know, at a high level and committed to getting those better. I personally still answer all my emails, and I get a lot of emails, but I enjoy actually interacting with people and talking to people and then helping them, you know, get better, whatever it is they're trying to do. I started working with a really big gym chain called Lifetime Fitness in the U.S., which has a million plus members. And I helped them develop their certification course for their 4,000 plus trainers and their $100 million plus business. So I enjoyed looking at how to build something like that on a huge scale. I do a lot of product development. So I create Morpheus and help the development of the software side of things. I do that. I mean, I like just doing diverse, you know, I like doing different things. I hate doing the same thing over and over again every single day. So I actually like the fact that I can do a lot of different things every day and I can interact with a lot of different people and play different roles. So I like where I'm at now, just from that standpoint of being able to pick and choose what I like to do. And most of it's just, comes back to figuring out how to help people get better. I like figuring out, you know, new ways of helping people improve their conditioning or improve their recovery. And I like seeing the results. You know, I love when I get an email back that someone says, "Hey, I tried this for the last 3 weeks. I feel better than ever. You know, that really worked. Thanks." Like just that kind of stuff. I love getting those sorts of emails. So I just like seeing, you know, how my ideas and experience can help people get better.
Mm. How, I have a question just on the work stuff. How relevant would you say for a lot of us, I think your main priority in life is your work in some sort and you work really hard, but you also do some training. How relevant would you say like HRV scores and things like the Morpheus are to your work? Like when you see yours, are you like, okay, cool, I can, you know, push it hard today, or like, you know, I've been traveling too much and I need to take it easy?
I think it actually is pretty relevant in terms of like a mentally demanding task, right? So if my HRV is poor, then I tend to not want to write articles, or I tend to not want to read a bunch of research, or I tend to not want to do things that are mentally demanding, because I'm probably not going to have the mental capabilities of focusing on it very well. Because HRV will correlate not just with physical performance, but with mental performance too. So if my HRV is toasted from a traveling or overtraining or whatever the hell I did that was stupid, then I tend to try to avoid or be aware that now is probably not a day to write a comprehensive article or go do a big, like I do a lot of video courses or put stuff like that where I've got to actually really think through the process. So I'm better off just sitting there answering emails or doing something that's a little bit less, mentally demanding. So you'll see it will definitely correlate in terms of like your ability to write or your ability to hypothesize different things or dig in the research. Like you just can't do it as well if you see your HRV tanked for whatever reason.
Mm. Yeah, that's super interesting. Yeah, cool. Well, we'll talk about more the Morpheus and stuff at the end, but we'll get into our final four questions unless Raph, you wanted to add something to... No? Okay, cool. So, Joel, we ask these questions to all our guests. I'm very curious of the answers. The first question is, if you had an opportunity to sit down and interview anyone that is alive today, and they would answer anything that you ask them honestly and truthfully, who would you choose to sit down and interview?
That's a tough question. You know, I don't know if you guys have read the book My Zebras Don't Get Ulcers with Robert Sapolsky, but I think Sapolsky, to me, is one of the more interesting guys out there. And he's a hell of an interesting guy. He's a lecturer at Stanford. He studied animals in the wild and did a bunch of primate research. But he's a biologist. I think I would actually sit down with him just because he's such a fascinating guy that's done so many different things. He also teaches like in the medical lab down at Stanford and like some of the brain research areas. Super, super fascinating guy. So I would just sit down with him. I think he's got a lot of really valuable insight into how human beings were designed and why we do the things we do, which to me is the most interesting stuff out there. Fitness is really fascinating, but just kind of how humans are hardwired and our basic biology and how it drives our decisions and our emotions and our reactions and our lives, I think is really fascinating. I think he would have probably, you know, as good or better answers from a biological perspective as anybody else out there. So I'd sit down with him.
Mm. Yeah, I just on that, because yeah, we have read his book and it's really good stuff. I actually was having a discussion the other day with someone, and maybe you actually have some insights on this, about fasting, like not intermittent fasting, but fasting more than the length of a light, like a full night and day cycle, so 24 hours plus sort of fasting. A guy called Matthew Walker, who's like a researcher on sleep, has been doing it for like 3 decades or whatever. He's got a book called Why We Sleep. I don't know if you're familiar with it or read it.
I've heard the book, but I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, it's really interesting. One of the parts he's talking about the impact of fasting on people's sleep. A lot of people, I don't know if you've picked up on people that do these long fasts, but they talk about how they need less sleep and they're waking up earlier than their normal sleep time and they're feeling more energized when they wake. And what he was actually saying is it's not actually a good thing. And he, same sort of thing. He was studying animals in the wild. And essentially what he was noticing is that, first of all, we are the only animal, as we know, that can really easily forego our what's hardwired in our biology, which is, you know, we need to sleep, but we're the only animal in the animal kingdom that can keep ourselves awake for long periods of time. Other animals don't do that. They're basically religious when it comes to bedtime. No matter which animal it is, the only exception that they have is when they're, you know, within the point of near death due to starvation. Is essentially what he studied was this mechanism or this hormone or whatever he theorizes gets released into the body to keep the animal energized and awake, because it's like, hey, you might die really soon.
Just gotta go eat, right? Because it's gotta go. Exactly. Basically trying to find food. Yeah, because I can see that making sense.
Yeah, and he was saying that is the same response that we have in our bodies when we forego long periods without food, is our body is releasing this, is using this same mechanism. You know, people say, oh, I have more energy, I'm sharper during the day, et cetera, et cetera. And what he's saying is, no, it's actually this insane stress response where the body's like, you need to eat now. I'm giving you this heightened state to be able to hunt still, to be able to run fast, to, you know, do all these things because, you know, I think that I'm about to drop dead and die.
That's definitely fascinating. It's definitely possible. I could see that making sense.
Mm, yeah. So I just thought it was really interesting. And wasn't sure if you thought about that or looked into it, but think that, yeah, a lot of people that do those long fasts probably putting undue stress on their system than what they need to for those long periods of time. Obviously, there's a lot of influential talking heads out there that probably talking a lot about bro science when it comes to fasting and potentially causing a lot of harm to some people that are going long periods of time without food.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's some research supports maybe the short-term fasting has some benefits, just some insulin sensitivity. But I think a lot of the long-term, extended periods of fasting or this idea the caloric restriction diet was going to make you live longer, like that really hasn't been borne out in the research. I mean, it works in animal models. I mean, when you keep animals calorically restricted for a longer period of time, you can extend their lifespan marginally. But to my knowledge, a lot of the research that's been done on human beings, like there was this whole group of people who try to eat very few calories and expected to live longer. It doesn't really work that way. So, I think in general, depriving your body of nutrients for extended periods of time is probably not the best way to be healthy. Even if it did expand your lifespan, what would the quality of life look like? I doubt we'd know the answer to that. But I think it makes sense in general. I mean, most of what we do, if you read Sapolsky's stuff, is basically to stay alive and to procreate. And like 99% of what our lives are, our instincts and our biology is driven to is to do those two things. So starving ourselves is definitely not something our body really wants to do for a long period of time. We actually want to get fat, right? We're much more prone to store fat than we are to be jacked and have a six pack. We actually kind of got to override our biology to do that because it's not very efficient to be super lean and muscular. It's a very poor thing as far as survival is concerned. If there ever was an apocalypse, all the bodybuilders would be dead because all their muscle tissue would eat everything up and they wouldn't be able to move.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be too surprised if something like that, you know, is going on from a biological level of, you know, hey, if you fast for a long period of time, sooner or later your body's gonna make a last ditch effort to try to get you to go move around and find food. And there's this whole thing called optimal foraging theory, where basically animals are kind of hardwired to figure out like how long should I stay and forage and food in one area, and if I don't find it, like should I go somewhere else? Because going somewhere else takes more energy to get to.
Yeah.
And am I riskier trying to make that 10-mile journey to go find food somewhere else? Or am I better off waiting here to see if food eventually shows up here?
Yeah.
There's a lot of calculation essentially that has to go into that, because if the animal makes the wrong choice and it goes 10 miles to try to find more food, there's no food there. Mm. It just expended energy for 10 miles and may die. So there's some interesting things, like I said, it's called optimal foraging theory. And basically it's how animals decide where to look for food and how long to look for food in that place before going somewhere else. So I think we're definitely, we can never escape the biology of like, we are hardwired to survive. And like I said, we're probably the only species out there that can override some of it in some sense. And we do so mostly in negative ways more than positive ones. So that's why I think the pulse could be so interesting. I have a guy to talk to, just I think from a biological standpoint, he's as knowledgeable as there is, and he's just a fascinating guy.
Mm. Yeah, he would be good. Maybe we can get him on the podcast.
If you can do that, let me know.
Yeah.
I do the same thing every day here. It's always weighing up, like, do I just go eat protein bars from the vending machine?
Yeah.
Or do I forage all the way out and get some proper food for lunch?
Yeah. Yeah.
But same internal battle.
You're weighing up how much time you can spend on a phone call only if there's a podcast you can listen to on the way.
Yeah. It's cost benefit analysis.
There you go. Cool. And then, Joel, second question. What routine do you do every single day? that you feel like is pretty essential to the success of each day?
I tend to get up. I do my little supplement ritual, which kind of depends on the day. And then I do 30 minutes of cardio almost every single day. I feel like it just helps me kind of focus in the day. I think about what I'm going to accomplish today. Gives me a little bit of just a little energy boost. You know, it's generally speaking, a couple of days a week, I'll do higher intensity. And the other times I'll just do kind of a lower intensity tempo intervals or some cardiac output or something along those lines. So I like to get started just by getting up and moving. And to me, when I get up, I do some breathing. I do 30 minutes or so of cardio. I end up feeling better and more energized for the rest of the day than when I skip it. So I try to get that in pretty much every day. And again, it's not like I go in there high intensity and kill myself for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Most of the time it's a lower to moderate intensity type exercise. But I feel just getting up and moving around just helps me start my day better than getting there and sitting in front of the computer right off the bat.
I'd say most people are probably less likely long-term to do the high intensity stuff every single day anyway, because of just the general fear that's associated with having to push yourself to that pain threshold every single day. It's much easier on yourself mentally knowing that, oh, I just have to get up and I just have to move for 30 minutes, you know, just get a bit of a sweat on and, you know, breathe and just feel better.
I feel much better when I do it than when I don't.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's a good one. I don't think we've ever had anyone say that in like 200 episodes about getting up and doing cardio. Most people just say coffee or read a book or something. So there you go. Mm. That's good. I guess it's appropriate. The conditioning, that's known mostly for conditioning. Says he does conditioning in the morning.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. All right. So third question is, recently, has there been anything that you've changed your mind on that for a long time you held as like a strong belief?
Recently? I don't know about recently. I would say just I'll just tell this, the story that's interesting that I'm known as the conditioning guy in general, because my whole career started on the strength side of things. I worked with a guy named Bill Gillespie at the University of Washington. He's a 700-pound bench presser powerlifter. Then went to Seahawks. My whole career was built around strength. And coming into the field, I thought basically strength is all you really needed. Like that was what I knew. If somebody was weak, I wanted to get them stronger. I really didn't know much about conditioning other than I figured you run some gassers and that was conditioning. So my whole paradigm when I got into strength conditioning was lots of strength and very little conditioning. And that's literally kind of the path I would have gone down. And I guarantee you I would still be talking about today if I hadn't started working with combat athletes. Hmm. And it was really only because I started training with them myself and getting my ass kicked, even though I was way stronger than they were, that I realized there was a whole different area of fitness and conditioning that I had no idea about and needed to educate myself about. So I would say even if you've built this whole paradigm up in your brain of what you think strength conditioning or what you think fitness is, like, don't be afraid that, you know, maybe something will come along that you need to be open to realizing that it's not necessarily the way you thought it was. Because again, if I had not worked with fighters, I probably would just be lifting a whole lot of weights and doing the same thing I was doing to start out my career. It was only because I trained a totally different group of athletes I knew nothing about that I had to rethink my entire approach to strength conditioning. And somehow I became known as the conditioning guy, even though, again, the first part of my career was entirely built around lifting weights and getting stronger and bigger. I would never in a million years have thought that I'd become the conditioning guy. It just kind of happened that way. So that was, you know, a huge change in my career path just because I worked with fighters versus football players, really.
Mm. Do you give much strength training now to your elite athletes?
It depends on the sport, right? But
so your combat athlete. Not
a whole lot. I mean, enough to keep it there. I mean, you don't want to lose strength. You want to still have that CNS development.
Yep.
But usually a couple of days a week is about all they need for the most part, unless it's somebody who's in a heavier weight class, you know, somebody who's maybe going to be in a wrestling type fight or somebody that needs that extra level of strength development. For the most part, though, you know, if you're training 4, 5, 6 days a week in MMA, you know, a couple of days of strength is really all you need.
Mm. Yeah, I can't imagine that you'd be giving DJ a lot of like one-arm back squats and deadlifts, because
no.
I couldn't imagine it would suit very well or be.
No, it wouldn't be appropriate, like you said. But that was the biggest thing that I had to change my mind about, is my whole paradigm was built around strength. And all of a sudden one day I was like, holy shit, this doesn't really work like I thought it did, because I'm way stronger than these guys and they're choking me out in 30 seconds. Something's not right here.
Yeah, I mean, if you bring up your neural drive too much with too much strength training, I feel like you would just put yourself in a position where you can just gas yourself super, super hard. Like, you look at those super high-end, high-power output fighters, you know, like Yoel Romero and Anthony Johnson.
They all gas.
They gas. They're empty.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely – there's always a trade-off, right? The more power and energy you produce, the less duration you can actually do it for. And if you go too far that direction, you're going to pay the price ultimately. If you get the knockout in the first round, great. But if you don't, then what?
Yeah. No, it's interesting. Even with guys like Conor McGregor, like when he gassed in that first fight with Nate, for pretty much everyone in the world watched that. I mean, the next thing you know, in his training camp, he was doing like, he was on a bike. He was on a road bike in Vegas doing laps around Las Vegas, you know, with a heart rate monitor on, trying to work on his, you know, cardiac output, because he realized, holy shit, like you can't go in there and do that. It's not a good strategy.
Yeah, he did two things. I think the second fight, he definitely improved his conditioning from that standpoint. And he looked, you could see he was a lot more patient, and he wasn't just winging bombs, you know, nonstop. Yeah. He was being more intelligent about how he managed his energy, which was, paid off for him. So, I think it's important to recognize that, you know, strength and power are cool, but again, you know, it's only one part of the equation.
Yeah, and like you said, it's the skill, right? Part of his conditioning was not just getting fitter or doing more time on the bike. It was like learning a different strategy so that if he has 100 units of energy in the fight, he doesn't tap to the 90, 95 in the first 2 minutes. You know, he just chips away at that 100 units more conservative.
Exactly.
Cool. And then Joel, final question. What is a book that you'd recommend for people and a favorite quote of yours?
So book, you know, there's a book that probably no one's read, I imagine, but it's called Illusions by a guy named Richard Bach. And I really like it for a few reasons. Number one, Richard Bach's a pilot. I'm a pilot. He's actually from around here, so I've seen him flying around, which is cool. But it's just a book about kind of, and the moral of the story is kind of you are your own guy. You're your own boss. You're your own, messiah, he calls it. Basically, like, you make your life how you want to be, and you got to kind of make it exactly how you want to be. You can't wait for somebody else to do it for you. And you can't, try to control things that are out of your control, but just, I just like it because it's basically, you know, it's a roadmap to like, okay, I need to take care of myself and make life how I want it. He tells a lot of stories that that I connected with and that I think are really good. I don't remember a specific quote from that book, but I've always liked Pink Floyd's All You Touch and All You See is All Your Life Will Ever Be. I think that's another powerful thing. Like, you know, I've traveled the world and done a lot of things, and I always kind of think about that, like, you know, in 100 years when every single person's dead on this earth, I want to, you know, have done as much and seen as much and been a part of as many things I could possibly be. So I've always tried to, you know, get out and explore the world and live life as much as I possibly can and do things I enjoy doing and, you know, find the right balance between life and work and, you know, not be somebody who's spending 90 hours a week in business the rest of my life, but be able to use business and use my company as a means to live the lifestyle I want to live. So those two, I think, would be the best for me.
That's awesome. Do you, just out of curiosity, do you have business partners in some of the stuff you're involved with?
Nope. I had a couple, but never really worked out over the years. So I've tended to kind of just stay on my own and have two different companies that I own basically 100% of one of them and just 90%+ of the other one. Yeah. And a couple investors in. But I've tended to just like to do things my way, and it's always worked out better when it's just me.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, makes sense. That's why it's been such a good result. So yeah, that's why that quote makes a lot of sense. So that's been awesome. So Joel, some of the stuff you shared today has been very insightful, and coming from you, it definitely holds a lot more weight than other people. So thank you for sharing that stuff and affirming a lot of our beliefs and maybe also squashing some myths that were out there as well. People can find all your stuff. The first place we definitely want to send them is 8weeksout.com. That's 8, the number 8. So don't spell it out, just number 8weeksout.com. And then can you tell us a little bit more about Morpheus and like how, like firstly Bioforce, like how it works, because some people have asked us about HRV in the past and we have used it as well in the past. We don't use it at the moment, but can you just give us a quick sort of summary of that and then what Morpheus is and how people can get their hands on it?
Yes, I started Bioforce HRV back in 2011, I believe it was. And I'd been using HRV since the early 2000s. And for those of your listeners who aren't too familiar, HRV is a tool to measure part of the nervous system that shows us the balance between stress and recovery. And it gives you a score that essentially allows you to measure that. And so Bioforce was my first product out there. It gave you a score and it gave you a color, a green, an amber, a red, that just helped you understand kind of where your recovery level was at. But then Morpheus, I essentially wanted to give people a much broader picture of recovery, because people would often see their recovery, their HRV, be a certain score, but they really wouldn't understand why it was that score. So, you know, I'd get questions like, well, why is it this or why is it that or what should I do about it? Well, Morpheus essentially kind of took those answers and put it into one system. So what Morpheus does now is it tracks your activity, your sleep, your training, your heart rate variability, and then subjective markers about soreness and nutrition quality and how you feel. And it takes all that information and it gives you a recovery score. And then from there, it allows you to see, okay, what's the appropriate level of intensity for me each day? So it gives you three heart rate zones a day. It gives you a blue zone to improve your recovery. It gives you a green zone to improve your conditioning. And it gives you a red zone, which is basically your red line or your overload zone, where if you spend too much time, you're going to overtrain. And then once you go in and do your workout, it's going to also then adjust your recovery score so you can see the immediate benefits or the impact of your workout. So if you go do a recovery workout and you spend most of your time in the recovery zone, you're going to see your recovery score increase by a few points. If you go in and do a really high intensity workout, you're going to see your recovery score decrease after that workout. So it's just it's an overall platform or tool to see how all the pieces of your lifestyle, again, your sleep, your training, your HRV, your nutrition, how all those things affect you, because it's tracking all that data and turning that into a recovery score and then these personalized heart rate zones for you each day. So I wanted to create something that would connect people's lifestyles and all the things that happen outside the gym to what their intensity and what their training needs to be inside the gym. And so, you know, it's really the first platform that I'm aware of that takes all those things out there and gives you a specific way to adjust your training. And if you want to go in and do rebound training today, you can make sure you're doing it right because your recovery score should increase at the end of the workout. If you want to go do high intensity, you can see exactly how hard you should push yourself without going too far the other direction. So it's really, I call it recovery, digital recovery coach. And that's really what it is, because it just helps you manage your conditioning, manage your recovery, and manage the stress of your life to ultimately get get better fitness and accomplish whatever you're trying to accomplish.
So do you wear it all day? It's like a wrist thing or
nope.
A strap?
Nope. So the Morpheus system comes as what I call the Morpheus recovery band. And that band is what allows you to measure HRV, does 2.5 minutes a day. And then as far as activity and sleep, there's a couple options. If you have a Fitbit or you have any other wearable device, it'll tap into that. It'll just pull the data from that already. If you don't have those things, then you just tell it basically to use your phone sensors and your phone can track your activity for you and you can tell it how much you slept. Mm-hmm. So it's flexible. If you have a wearable, it can pull the information out there. If you don't have a wearable, then you just let it track the information from your phone.
So you basically take your HRV, I guess, in the morning once a day with it. And it tells you your recovery and then you just put in the stuff that you do during the day.
Yeah, so you like I said, you take your recovery score once a day, and then when you measure your activity or sleep, it just you put in your sleep manually or you let it track from your phone. And then when you're doing your workout, it gives you these zones, like it's an actual heart rate monitor during the workout. So as you're training, you'll see basically if you're in your blue, your green, or your red zone, and you get these colorful workouts where basically it shows you how much time you spent in each zone for that particular workout, and then I'll show you how your recovery score adjusts afterwards. So if I could do a whole bunch of time in my conditioning zone, I'm going to see my recovery score decrease maybe 5 to 10 points after that workout. So it's a gauge of how hard did I really push myself during that workout. And again, those zones are going to change every day based on my recovery. So if my recovery is high, then my zones are going to be higher. If my recovery is low, my zones are going to be lower. So it allows you to personalize your training, your conditioning, your recovery on a daily basis, which is really what it comes down to. Because if I didn't sleep well the night before, or I didn't eat as well as I could have, or maybe I traveled, or maybe I trained hard yesterday, it's going to reflect that the following day and what my heart rate zones look like for that particular day. So it's just a way to personalize each and every day and take it to the next level, because again, you're getting that personalization every day.
Yeah, it's awesome. I think that basically anyone that's, especially people that are more advanced with their training, anyone that's kind of plateaued a little bit over the last few years and doesn't really know why or just doesn't feel good in training anymore, it's definitely a powerful tool. The website is trainwithmorpheus.com. Morpheus is MORPHEUS. So trainwithmorpheus.com. You guys can get on that. We'll probably pick ourselves up one and test it and review it on the show. So we know it's going to be good, Joel. It's not going to get anything less than a 4 out of 5. So no pressure.
Is there anything that you see, because we get these questions all the time and we reviewed one of them last week on the podcast, leaving aside like the rebound workouts and sleep and all the shit that works, is there anything like the float tank, cryotherapy, like the sauna, like a massage, like anything you go that I guess you pay for in some way that you reliably see improve your HRV or improve recovery?
In the short term, yes, right? Like anything that you find to be personally relaxing that helps you shut off that sympathetic response, is beneficial and that it helps you accomplish that. I can guess the question is like, is that going to cause a long-term change? Like, probably not. It's more about just the short term, like, hey, it's going to help you relax in the moment and and get your body, you know, recovered for the next hour or two. The question, you know, I think for most people is how do they do this stuff on a more regular basis? Because how often are you going to get a float tank? Once a week, you know, or twice, you know, a month? I mean, are you going to go spend $50 every day? No. I mean, it's to me, it's more about those things are like a little, you know, jump starts, a little boost when you really need something to help get your body back to normal. But for the most part, I think recovery needs to be, you know, just a bigger picture of how you train and how you eat and how you sleep and all the things we've talked about. And those little things can just be added in, you know, when necessary or on top of that. But I don't think there's something that you can rely on because they're cost prohibitive, they're time prohibitive. I mean, you're not going to go do those things every single day. I'll say the one thing I would say I've used quite a bit is the sauna. Actually, I think the sauna is probably the easiest way to get some recovery benefits. If you have a sauna in your gym, there's some benefits to doing that on a more regular basis. But most of those things, I think, you know, are secondary to making sure you've got everything else in order. To me, those are like your supplements, right? Your diet's got to be in order before you add in a whole bunch of supplements. So, you know, make sure your training, your sleep, your nutrition, all those sorts of things are dialed in, and then look to add all those things on. Because I think people tend to do the reverse. Like, their eating's not great, their sleep's not great, they're really stressed out, but they go to float tank once a week. Mm. Like, get your foundation right first, right?
Yeah. 28 cans of Coke and then just the float tank. Yeah.
Yeah.
It.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a Microsoft executive prescription for health.
Yeah, there you go.
Awesome. All right, fantastic. Joel, thanks so much for being on. And I'm sure we'll be able to send many people to get their training sorted.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, guys.
All right, what an amazing podcast from Joel. Joel, thanks so much for being on the show. It was an honor. Guys, remember, we are going to bring Joel out later this year to do some conditioning courses. So if that stuff is of interest to you, we will have something for you. So make sure you follow us on Instagram so you can stay up to date with all the updates that we have. But of course, you can always listen to us here. And just like Joel's an author, we are authors as well. You can pick up the Training Journal if you want to achieve your number one goal in 100 days or less at thetrainingjournalbook.com. You guys can pick up a copy of that straight away. We restocked our levels in the States and for Europe and the UK. So make sure you guys check that out. And also, as always, you can go to trueprotein.com.au. My recommendation was True Post for this month. So True Post has beta alanine in it, which helps with lactate buffering. Use our code MINDMUSCLE10, get 10% off at checkout. All right, thanks, guys, and we'll see you next week. Thank you, Project, for tuning in again to another episode of the Mind Muscle Project. We release an episode every single Monday. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, the Mind Muscle Project, to stay up to date with everything we're doing. And if you have some time, leave us a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes.
And don't forget, we have a second show of the week, The After Show. So it's no longer a rest day on Thursdays. If you have any questions for Lachlan and I for that show, head to themindmuscleproject.com/The After Show. And if you ask a question, we'll answer it on the show.
Thanks again so much, Project, and we'll see you all next week.